Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On My Mind This Week, if anyone thought the end of 2018 would bring calm to Washington, the last several days have certainly proved them wrong. Defense Secretary James Mattis has quit over a rift with President Trump. The debate continues on building a wall, and the Mueller investigation seems to be closing in on the president and his inner circle. To help make sense of it all, I invited veteran political analyst David Gergen to join me on the podcast. He served as a White House advisor to four U.S. presidents, including Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton. He currently directs the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School. David Gergen, how wonderful to have you on the podcast.
Oh, it's such a terrific reunion, Diane. I've missed you over these years, and I'm delighted to talk to you again.
Thank you. There is so much happening this week, especially with the resignation of General Mattis as director of DOD, the pullout from Syria, the drawdown from Afghanistan, and the fight over building a wall. What is happening here?
It's hard to describe for every one of us, isn't it, Diane, because it's so strange. We've never seen anything like this before. We've been in unprecedented territory for months and months now, and the pace of chaos just seems to be picking up. I don't know about you, but when I heard the Mattis news, it gave me a pit in my stomach. I just really felt, for the first time, felt very nervous about the country's future.
Whose advice do you believe the president is taking other than his own?
I think he's restricting himself to his own advice. And on occasions, at the periphery of his concerns, he will listen to people. You know, Jared Kushner had obviously had a lot of influence over the president with regard to the passage of this criminal justice bill, which was a good thing. I mean, in the midst of all of this awfulness,
that
at least we can salute as a model of bipartisanship. But beyond that, clearly on the national security side, which is the president's weakest point, I mean, the issues that he's least acquainted with, he's listening to almost no one. One thought only a few days ago that his new Secretary of State, Pompeo, would have a lot of influence over him. But that has clearly not been the case. The president overrode him. His own Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, his National Security Advisor, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whoever you can name, he overrode their wishes and deciding to withdraw precipitously from Syria and at the same time to begin making moves to withdraw from Afghanistan, leaving our friends who've been fighting with us and whom we persuaded to fight with us in Syria against ISIS. We had a large Kurdish group was working with us. We've left them on the battlefield to be slaughtered by the Turks. And, you know, I think one of the reasons Jim Mattis resigned was you don't leave your people on the battlefield.
Yeah.
That's been his theory, you know, for decades.
He said, I have to resign because our thoughts about how to move forward are not the same. Our differences are greater than our similarities.
Yes. I thought as much as I hoped he would stay through the first term, and as much as we've all relied upon General Mattis to be the anchor, the restraining force in the administration on this president, I have friends who believe he made a mistake. He should have stayed out of duty to the country. My own feeling is, thank goodness Jim Mattis was there for this length of time. Thank goodness he was willing to take what must have been psychological torture for him to see this president again and again go down roads he recommended against. In the larger context, Diane, what's worth remembering is that for over seven decades, democracies all over the world have looked to the United States to be the leader in preserving the peace, enlarging possibilities for mankind, in advancing the world. And the world has been largely at peace with NATO. We haven't had any world wars. We had two world wars in the first half of the 20th century. We haven't had any world wars in 70 years since. And that is because the United States took the lead, but we had strong partnerships, reliable partnerships, trust on both sides across much of the world. And, you know, as China has been growing in power, one thing we had over China was we had friends in the region. They had almost no friends in Asia. We're in swift retreat, and we're kicking all that over. Jim Mattis was the man in the administration who stood up for those old values, for those time-honored principles. He was very much in the mainstream of national security consensus that we've had for 70 years. And it just must be agony for him to see this president kick it away so dismissively as he is.
Indeed. You worked for four presidents. Now we're close to 2 years in this administration. Have you ever seen any parallels to what's happening now with what happened during any of those other administrations?
There are not many parallels. The one that obviously jumps out, I did work for Richard Nixon when I was young, and he was in scandal. He was engulfed by scandal. It was appropriate that he leave. It was a tragedy for the country and for him, but nonetheless, it was the right thing. And obviously, you know, we now have a president who seems to be surrounded by men who can't tell the truth, who are seem to be crooked, who have been lying or going to jail. So there's that obvious parallel. But I must say there are differences. Nixon's misadventures, his lawbreaking, was much more contained to two or three institutions, the FBI, the CIA, the White House. All of those were involved in the Justice Department in breaking the laws. Here, in this administration, the wrongdoing is not limited. It's massive. And it goes in one agency after another. We can't keep up with it from day to day. I mean, the Secretary of the Interior, who's now resigning, you know, that in the Nixon days would have been a huge story. Today, things are moving so rapidly. There's so much apparent corruption across the board that it just gets swept away in our public discourse. And let me just say, I think we almost can't take it in how different this is from the traditions that have been the models for this country. I grew up during the Eisenhower years. What was striking about that was there was only one public occasion that I can recall when he lied to the public, and he regretted it the rest of his days. It occurred over Francis Gary Powers, you know, flying U-tubes over over the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Yeah, we were spying on them as they were spying on us.
Indeed.
And Powers went down, and Eisenhower thought he'd been killed. And then Eisenhower went out and claimed the pilot was lost his way and it's not our fault and we didn't do anything wrong, et cetera, et cetera. And then Khrushchev produced Powers and showed that Eisenhower had been lying. That was a huge blow to Eisenhower. But think of that. One lie, you know, it was like occupied him and he was distraught over it. We've got a president, according to his latest numbers that the Washington Post has been keeping, has lied anywhere from misled us anywhere from 6,000 to 8,000 times.
Wow.
Just it's so preposterously different.
Do you think it is because, unlike any other president we've had, his vast experience was as a performer and not in politics? So he came in thinking, I know everything I need to do.
Mm-hmm. I do think that's part of it. Because he had been a successful performer, you have to say he's a master salesman. He was very good at marketing himself and marketing his ideas during the campaign, and that's how he won. He was able to capture in just these little phrases, capture the personality of someone and diminish them, and that's how he emerged with the nomination and then the election. Having said that, however, It's not just a question of being ill-prepared, lacking any preparation, really. But it's really a question of character. If his character was right, we wouldn't be getting into a lot of these scrapes that we're in. We wouldn't be having as many investigations that are underway. If he was a person of good character, good public character, I think we overemphasize private the private lives of people, but we ought to hold them to higher account for their public lives. And this man has gotten away with things that I think are not just wrong, but they're destructive of our democracy. The biggest problem with Trump right now is how much of a threat he poses to our democracy, to our principles, to our values, and to the guardrails that we've had that have kept us out of trouble for lo these many decades.
You know, there are a number of people who ask what responsibility the media actually bears for the polarization in this country today. You are a member of the media.
Yep.
You speak on CNN quite frequently. How do you answer that?
I do believe that this should be a time of greater introspection on the part of the media. When this is all over, I think we do need to seriously look over where we went wrong and where we went right. I think overall, and I'm biased on this, I do have a contract with CNN. I think overall, the press, CNN, MSNBC, the mainstream newspapers and so forth, and the over-the-air broadcasters have acted as a check to some degree on the president. You know, we need checks and balances in our system. That's quite obvious once again. And I think to a considerable degree, the accountability has been coming, and the push for accountability is coming heavily from the press. Having said that, it is also true that in the months leading up to the elections themselves, we gave Trump an enormous amount of free airtime.
Yep.
And Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN, has said that if looking back, if there was one thing he would question, it would be whether we became enablers because we were so attracted to these rallies. Now, you know, there was a dilemma, as you all understand, for the media about how much of Trump to carry. On one hand, you wanted to give sort of equal time to all the candidates, which certainly did not happen. On the other hand, if Donald Trump was hurling a rally and 13 or 14,000 people were going to show up and down the street, Jeb Bush or someone like him was going to hold a rally or a meeting and meet in a public library somewhere, one is news and the other is not. And so you're compelled, I think, to recognize those differences. And so I think giving a lot of that time in some ways, I think it was a dilemma. I think it was a hard call.
So in the future, how do you see reporters changing their approach?
The other part of this, and I think this is the most obvious part, is I do worry now that there are times we see in the press, and I include myself in this, that we look like we're in a fox hunt. We're chasing a prey. And, with the honors going to the team that can catch him. And I think that's very dangerous. We're so aghast at what Trump represents that sometimes think we get too wound up in it and we're not caring enough of the rest of the news, which is actually very, very important about our future. The climate story, while getting more attention, is nowhere near as big on our radar screen as it should be. And you can say that about several other areas. What's been going on in healthcare and the mess we have in healthcare right now and the mess we're going to continue to have deserves far more attention. What's going on overseas, especially with China and Russia, deserves far more attention. The weaknesses in Europe that our greatest partner is in some trouble. And that's one of the reasons why when Mattis goes and you've got weakness in governance across much of the democratic world – and increasingly authoritarian world, it's very, very troublesome. It's very dangerous. So I think if I would ask of anything of all of us as we go forward, we're coming down to what could be a tumultuous time, even more tumultuous with the Mueller report. I think it's really, really important to try to keep things in perspective, to stay close to the truth, to let the truth be our guide, not our emotions. I worry a lot that if Trump were to go down in the next few months, and he might, that there would be a large chunk of the country, 30, 40, 50%, who would partly hold the media to blame and would say that the media, ginned this up and worked with the left and the Democratic Party, worked with the universities and all the rest, that this was somehow a conspiracy to bring down Donald Trump. I do not believe that. I think Donald Trump just like Richard Nixon is the architect of his own troubles. But I do think that our citizenry increasingly believes that we're too biased.
Now a quick break. When we return, more of my conversation with David Gergen.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Washington veteran David Gergen. It's interesting, these midterm elections seem to have indicated a strong rebuke from at least a portion of the population. Does that indicate to you a new thinking on the part of many?
I do think, to their credit, there are people who have been for him who are rethinking and are saying, I didn't fully appreciate we needed change, still believe we need change. Some of his ideas are good, and I just wish he'd clean up his act and be more honest and that sort of thing. I think there are people like that. But the dam hasn't yet broken the way it did with Nixon. And the Nixon case, had a growing unpopularity, but it was only when the smoking gun came out, when we got the tapes, and I was working in that White House, that you knew it was over, that his support collapsed in the Republican Party. I must say, I think the Republican Party, which once was a proud part of our tradition, needs to go through some reevaluation, serious reevaluation, when this is over too, because you know they're in a slow, suicidal position right now. From my perspective, maybe they'll show some spine here in the future weeks. By the way, a lot of them are breaking away from the president over Madison, over Syria, and that sort of thing, and over the budget. So maybe we're on the edge of the Republican Party trying to revive itself by trying to be more of a model.
What do you think we will see in the coming weeks and perhaps months coming from the Mueller report?
Well, like you, I'm as much in the dark as everyone else, and this is purely speculative. It's just hard for me to believe that Mueller would have been working this long, this hard, with such a competent group of people around him, unless there were something there. It may not be, you know, violations of the law as such, but you know, Alan Dershowitz makes the argument that the political uproar may be bigger than the legal uproar. I think that may be true. That there may be. You know, there may be things here that really disgust us or alarm us, but that are arguably within the realm of what the president is allowed to do. The emoluments question, or the question, for example, of how much money he's made, how much money his family has made, while they have been sort of elevated to the top of the American political heap. You know, they really raked it in some cases. And they're continuing to pursue, you know, opportunities. Now, most of us are pretty outraged by that. But is it within the purview of the president? Is it unconstitutional under the Emoluments Clause? That may be a harder question to answer.
Do you think his children could be at risk?
Yes. For some time now, I and many others have been asking the question, are we going to see with Trump what we saw with Flynn? And in Flynn's case, the folklore already has it. In Flynn's case, coming in as national security director, the Mueller didn't have a lot that he could pin down on Flynn, but they did get the goods on the son, on his son, and then they were able to squeeze the father to cooperate if they wanted to spare his son. You know, so the question becomes, it looks like there are trails that lead to Donald Trump Jr. and possibly to Jared that are certainly worth exploring on Mueller's part. If those trails wind up, you know, showing a colorable violation of the law, it may well be that Mueller can then go to Trump and say, okay, time for you to really talk.
Wow. That would be quite something.
Would be.
I was so interested, David, at the judge's rebuke of General Flynn the other day at his sentencing. What do you think that was all about? Why is this sentencing now postponed? What does the judge hope to get in response from that postponement?
Well, I think the judge, who had appointments from both sides of the aisle by presidents on both sides, and is seen as a fair but tough judge, there was a real hope on the part of Flynn and the White House that essentially, because Flynn has shown some cooperation, that he would not go to jail, and that the judge would see that point of view. So it was completely unexpected that he instead was going to slam him over the head, and took a very strong moral stance. And what was interesting to me, Diana, is that judge's decision and then the Mattis letter, if you put those back to back, it's almost as if the conversation is changing. It's being taken out of the hands of the pundits and put into institutional settings where very powerful people are saying, this is an outrage. And we are not going to stand for it. We're going to take measures. This administration, if it's going to go over the line, is going to be held accountable. I think that is healthy, actually.
I wonder, looking ahead to the next year, what you see as winning issues for Democrats, considering the fact that they had the House but not the Senate.
I'd first of all say I think the conventional wisdom has already shifted on Nancy Pelosi. She has handled herself extremely well.
I think so.
In these last few weeks, and standing up to the president the way she did in the Oval Office and backing him into a corner from which he's still struggling to extricate himself. Yeah, and the way she's been sort of downplaying impeachment, my understanding is she's telling people, I don't want to pursue impeachment unless the Republicans want it. She's clearly, I think that's a very smart move on her part, showing restraint. I think the Democratic Party is going to be very well served by having her there. And it turns out she's going to be more of a strength than anybody anticipated, even just a few weeks ago. And by the way, I do hope that this is also a foretaste of what's to come in the House and increasingly in the rest of our politics when the number of women who are at the table grows. And it's going to be so – I think our politics could change. One of the great hopes in the country right now is that the entry of lots and lots and lots of women into public life will change our politics.
And what about issues for Republicans? Yeah. What do you see them pushing?
Well, let me just finish one second with the Democrats on what they should – what I think they can be pushing. I think they can present proposals – now in the House and see if they can't be put up for consideration, that in effect would become an agenda for the party coming out of the convention with a new nominee. Right now it's easy to say Donald Trump is going to face a defeat in 2020, but it's really hard to say who will beat him. When you go candidate by candidate on the Democratic side, it's not as obvious that he would lose or that the Democrats would win, but they could build up a storehouse of ideas that would be, in effect, the basis for governing if they were to win back the Senate and the White House. Remember, this is essentially what Newt Gingrich did way back in 1994.
Right.
Was he laid out a national agenda for the future of the Republican Party, and that became the rallying cry that allowed them to sweep back into power. And I think the Democrats have to be obviously have to find a person of character, someone who's reliable, who is in effect the anti-Trump. But they also need a storehouse of ideas so people think this is going to be a responsible party and they will serve the country well.
Do you think that that's what was lacking in the 2016 election?
I thought the 2016 elections were, I mean, to be fair, there were things that happened to Mrs. Clinton that were unfair to her. The Comey, the way the emails were handled, especially there in those last days, the lack of accountability. We still don't know the full story about how much the Russians distorted things. There were a lot of things that were out of her hands. But it's also true that she was seen as too sort of too much of a figure of the past, of ideas that had been increasingly grown stale, that didn't have a sense of the vitality of, say, of Silicon Valley, of these new industries that are coming online, of how the future could be reshaped. She seemed very much more of a conventional, you know, figure who was not thinking freshly about the future. And what Americans, I think our historians are incredibly important to us these days, but we tend to be a very forward-looking people. And we tend to be, what's next? You know, what's coming? Here's how do we conquer this next mountain?
And do you think the Republicans have a fresh set of ideas other than building a wall?
Building a wall and cutting your taxes, or cutting somebody else's taxes, especially if they're rich, right? That, of course, would be the case. No, I think the Republicans are pretty much out of ideas, too. This has been a I mean, who the heck knows what Republicans stand for anymore, because Trump's going down one road. They're all starting to split off. I mean, do we have a policy toward the Middle East? Or do we have a strategy in the Middle East? I don't think so. Do we have a strategy toward China? No. No, we don't. We haven't really reached a consensus. You know, it goes back to the question of leadership. An incumbent president like Trump in normal times would try to be building a consensus on two or three big, big issues, get them done, you know, solve some big problems, then seek reelection. And here we're just off at sixes and sevens. We don't know where the hell we are any day of the week. It's not clear what it means to be a Republican anymore.
So when you say a normal president,
yes,
you think that Donald Trump is an abnormal president?
Off the charts. On a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being abnormal, he's about 25.
Wow. David, what gives you the most hope for the new year?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because I tend to be a short-term pessimist. I think we're going to continue to be in a dark chapter of American life for the next months, if not a few years. But I'm a long-term optimist, and I do believe that one of the great remarkable aspects of American life is that we're resilient people. We get knocked down, but what's important is how often we get back up, you know, knocked down by the Depression, knocked down by the war, and then yet we came roaring back. You know, we've been knocked down numerous times, Vietnam, Watergate, and we've managed to snap back in most cases. But importantly, I think there's some other things that are really new, Diane, and that one of them is, again, to go back, I think the coming to power of women is going to transform a lot of our public discourse and our agenda. You know, we know women are more empathic, they're more cooperative, they're more collaborative. We see from Nancy Pelosi as well as others, you know, you can go through the list of women who also, like Thatcher, who can be very tough, you know, can be just as tough as men. Thatcher once said, if you want someone to give a speech, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. I always like that quote.
But you know what bothers me is, what's it going to take to mend relations with countries like Canada, Britain, Germany, our basic allies? What's it going to take?
It's a good question, Dan. I have the luxury now of being in the privilege, really, of teaching at a great university. And so, you know, occasionally I actually read a book. And there are a number of books out now that have come out about the threats to democracy across the world. There's a book in particular that I recommend to people called How Democracies Die, How Democracies Die, by two Harvard professors. It's short, it's accessible, and it's very compelling. And they make the argument that at the root of what we're facing now in working with other countries, other democratic countries, is that times have changed significantly. After the Second World War and up until the end of the Cold War, democratically elected countries did go down, not often, but they did, usually at the hand of generals, usually through coups. The number of coups in the world has actually declined quite a lot. But something else has happened since the end of the Cold War, and that is that democracies are falling apart from within, and over a dozen major significant countries, democratically elected leaders, once in office, have taken their people down a road toward authoritarianism. And we see that all across Western Europe now, whether it's in Hungary or Poland or especially Turkey. You see now this alternative right group is growing up in Italy. Merkel is obviously under huge pressure. We have Brexit and you know, coming out of Britain. We've got Trump in the United States. And then we look to – there are two people we've looked to for good governance. One is in France and Macron. Paris has been in flames.
Yes.
I mean, it's been terribly disturbing. Yes. Now, Trudeau is doing well in Canada. Especially he's doing well in the appointment of women and moving forward on the environment and that sort of thing. Even he's under some political pressure. But in country after country in the democratic world, democracies are in trouble. They're under huge pressure. And I think the role of the United States is not only to rebuild the trust and the reliance of us as a leader, but to help lead the world out of this what is becoming an increasingly dangerous period. You know, between the First World War and the Second World War, the number of democracies in the world declined significantly. We're in another such decline, and we need to pull ourselves together here at home so that we can help lead the world back to a sane and a place where children can still realize their hopes and dreams.
And David, speaking of leadership, I understand you are stepping down from your position as director of the Center for Public Leadership.
Yes.
I'm sorry to hear that. I congratulate you. What will you be doing? You'll continue to teach?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'll do, Diane, thank you for asking us. First thing I will do is greet our new director. My successor is Wendy Sherman. She's wonderful and very strong, and I'm looking forward to working with her. We've formed a nice bond in this transition.
Great.
That I'm pleased about. We also have recruited in a new professor who was Cornell Brooks, who was head of the NAACP.
Oh, yes. So,
and then we've also recruited in, and he's going to be arriving this coming summer, is Arthur Brooks, who has been a very successful president of the American Enterprise Institute. This is a guy who runs a center-right think tank, major success, and yet he just got back from Dharamsala, where he was with the Dalai Lama, because they worked together, and they are planning a book on compassionate leadership.
Huh. Yeah.
And Arthur Brooks then will bring a voice of diversity, intellectual diversity, to the campus. So I'm really excited about what's ahead with the Leadership Center. I believe very strongly that our higher education institutions, and indeed K-12, need to pay attention to nurturing the leaders of the future. We talked about women. I've been very involved in trying to get more young veterans elected to office. We made a lot of strides here in this last election. I went out and campaigned and did fundraisers for a number of them, several of them my former students. And I'm really excited about the quality of the younger generation that's coming. I think there's some wonderful talent there. They're sick and tired of the politics of today. They hate the gridlock. There's a lot of idealism in this younger generation that I think we need to nurture and not turn them into cynics. So I am very, very hopeful about the long-term future.
Well, that's a great message for our last podcast of the year, David. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah. No, thank you. It's a privilege to talk to you anytime. And you've done so much as in your own way as a voice of reason, of sort of sanity, and you're curious and you're not trying to – you don't have a big agenda you're trying to push on people. You're just trying to find the truth. And that's ultimately what journalism is all about.
David, thank you so much. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
Same
to
you
good
and your family.
Care of yourself.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's all for today. On My Mind, we'll be taking a break for the holidays. But while we're away, I wanted to share with you two of my favorite interviews from years past. We'll release those on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. Our first new episode of 2019 will be on Tuesday, January 8th. Until then, I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail, The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week were Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urib-Lipker. I hope you have a wonderful and safe and happy holiday. I'm Diane Reed.